This is 89.9 WWNL. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a celebration of the city's unique music culture, a talk with an acclaimed painter, or an evening of opera, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. There is a saying that music bubbles up from the cracks in the city's streets and sidewalks. Now, Soundtrack of New Orleans, a public celebration of the Amistad Research Center's 52nd anniversary, honors music legends and community leaders that help spread our unique culture around the world. Amistad's executive director, Dr. Kara Olledge, and legendary guitarist Deacon John are here. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure. Always.
Why is the city's music culture the focus of your 52nd anniversary celebration, Kara?
When we did our 50th, we really focused on a multimedia presentation and theater. And this year, we thought about all of the sounds, particularly with Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, tricentennial book, the catalog that talked about New Orleans as a global city. And the one thing that caught my attention is that you can't go anywhere without hearing music from New Orleans or finding out, if you're buying music, that someone from New Orleans has played on a track. And we thought that was very exciting. Just recently, I found out, and I didn't know this, that Dr. John played on Aretha Franklin's Rose in Spanish Harlem and Young, Gifted, and Black. And I think that we should celebrate musical legends who've come before and the work that they've done. So we've gone all the way back to what they say is the first jazz song to ever actually be recorded, and that was Jelly Roll Morton's Jelly Roll's Blues. And so we wanted to take it all the way back and bring us as much as that musical journey to date.
Now, everyone might not know about the holdings of the Amistad Research Center. Tell us about this treasure on Tulane University's campus and of the importance of the collection.
Our collections and our holdings are actually rooted in the American Missionaries Association. It goes back to 1839 with the Amistad incident with the abolitionists. At that time, our former president, John Quincy Adams, working to free this group of illegally enslaved Africans. This is a case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they won their freedom. And so our holdings date back to that incident. Our holdings really focus on education, civil rights. We have a wonderful fine arts collection that goes back to the 1800s. We've tried to be the keeper of the records that focus on social justice, all things related to culture as it defines communities like African-American fine art, as well as education.
Now, what role has music played in defining New Orleans, Deacon?
Well, I'll tell you like Ernie Cato once said, I don't know, but I believe all music started in New Orleans.
And you continue to play a big role in the music culture with a career spanning decades. Take us back to the late 50s when your star began to rise.
Well, some of the highlights were segregation. My musical career started during the era of segregation. And the culture, you know, was kind of centered around the African-American businesses. Like the Dewdrop Inn was like the cultural mecca because it was the premier nightclub and supper club in New Orleans. This is where the elite meet. So you had floor show that you couldn't see nowhere else. And the proprietor of the Dewdrop was Frank Panier. He was a very astute businessman. He would tip the cab drivers $5 to drop off a load to come to his shows at the Dewdrop. And he had this huge assortment of characters that hung out at the Dewdrop because we couldn't go to Bourbon Street. We couldn't go nowhere else. So we had the best of talent there, too, because Frank Panier, you know, he had a one-stop place. He had a hotel upstairs, rooms by the day, by the week, by the night, sometimes by the hour. And he also had a barbershop and beauty salon next door. And he had a restaurant, you know, that his brother ran and the nightclub itself. So he had everything you want right in one stop. Big name people like Ray Charles, Bobby Blue Bland, Jackie Wilson, man. everybody would come to the Dewdrop because they knew that's where everything was happening, and had these historic jam sessions that would last until the sun came up. And the traveling musicians would jam with the local musicians, and they had all these head-cutting contests to see who could play the best. When I became of age, you know, I started hanging out there, too. I had a very popular group back then, you know, Deacon John and the Ivories. I played there with Arthur Prysock, Bobby Blue Bland, and then Frank would always have a floor show with a quote-unquote exotic dancer. He had magicians, he had ventriloquists, vocal groups, instrumentalists, Red Prysock, Arthur Prysock, and he had all of these people before they got famous. I saw Lil Willie John come in there one night. He had a big roll of cash, big enough to choke a horse, and he was a prankster. Willie John come in there and say, "When I drink, everybody drinks. Set up the house, Frank." Then he'd sneak out the back door and catch a cab. Wouldn't pay the bill. That's the era that I came up in, the late 50s, early 60s. One night, Alan Toussaint walked in. He said, "I like the way you play that guitar." He said, "You want to come play on some recording sessions with me?" Man, my eyes lit up like they were on fire. Because, you know, if you were good enough to play on a recording session, that meant you have arrived on the scene. But the next day, I went down to Cosimo Studio and Governor Nichols, and there was the great Ernie Cato sitting in there waiting on me.
Who are the honorees, and who are the musical performers?
The honorees for this year's 52nd anniversary celebration, they are Vera Warren, founder of Community Bookstore, Alden J. McDonald, president and CEO of Liberty Bank, and the Marsalis family, the first family of jazz. We have a fantastic list of performers, starting with Claudia Hayden Project. She has been a musical producer for this project, a wonderful jazz flautist. She's pulled together a fantastic band. Our featured performer is none other than Deacon John himself, Sheila K. Davis, a vocalist and performer on Broadway. We also have our very own Sharon Martin, Michaela Harrison, fantastic singer, Patricia Lacey, who is one of the founders of Sounds of Blackness and was one of Luther Vandross's backup singers. Other performers include a Rebirth Brass Band, Darrell Bankston, and of course, Jermaine Basil, who will be honoring the Marsalis family.
As we look ahead, what does the future hold for the Amistad Research Center as one of the keepers of our city's rich culture?
A lot of times, you know, when people think of archival institutions, they think that they have an end date, that they collect up to a certain period, and that's what they represent. But the Amistad is continuously collecting in all facets of what our mission speaks to: education, human rights initiatives, social justice, civil rights initiatives, and cultural aspects regarding the arts.
Amistad Research Center Executive Director, Dr. Kara Olledge, and legendary guitarist, Deacon John. Thanks for stopping by.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Always a pleasure. Always.
The Amistad Research Center celebrates its 52nd anniversary with Soundtrack of New Orleans. Friday, September 28th, 6:30 p.m. at the Orpheum Theater. More info at amistadresearchcenter.org. Acclaimed North Shore artist and New Orleans native Emery Clark is being honored with a retrospective exhibit opening this week in Covington in Christwood Retirement Community's Atrium Gallery. Clark has immersed herself in nature in a decades-long career capturing the essence and healing power of a natural environment. Emery Clark joins us by phone. Emery, congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Diane.
This is quite an honor. What goes through your mind as you look back on your career?
Oh, it's wonderful doing a retrospective. I haven't seen all my work together in 20 years. I can see the journey I've been on, making the landscapes, the seascapes, the marshscapes, and then now how I'm using them in healing.
When did you know that art was your calling?
I got an award in kindergarten. And I went on from there, and I was blessed to have a very talented cousin who was teaching graduate school at the University of Florida when I was about 10 years old. She taught me a lot of painting and drawing between the time I was 10 and 12.
And you went on from there?
I took art lessons when I was at Ursuline. There was a wonderful third-story studio up in that Gothic building, and I had a wonderful teacher, Jean Gross. She went on to teach at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, and I had wonderful teachers there the whole time. And my best friend and I used to alternate every year with the Arts Award, Catherine Meyer. And then I went on to Newcomb and studied sculpture, painting, printmaking, photography, and drawing. And then in 1969, I went to the Boston University School of Fine Arts because that was one of the last schools in the country at that time teaching classical painting and drawing. And then I went to Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture in Maine. I was lucky enough to be awarded a Thomas J. Watson Traveling Fellowship. They financed my travels through North Africa, Europe, the Near East, the Yucatan, and I was able to study how art was integrated into cultures. And so that was the focus of my work from then on, was how to make art a relevant part of contemporary culture in the United States.
And I believe it was in the 1970s that you were among a group of artists who founded the Contemporary Arts Center here in New Orleans?
Yes, that was wonderful. Luba Glade, the art critic, had an idea to start a Center for Contemporary Arts. I think about seven of us, Don Dito, Luba Glade, Bob Tannen, and Gene Nathan. And we met, and Luba Glade approached Sidney Bestoff about his building, and he was generous enough to loan that wonderful old K&B building on Camp Street, where the Contemporary Arts Center still is. So our dream became a reality, and Don Marshall became the first director. And by the way, he came and hung my show for me, which was so wonderful to have his eye after all these years doing that. It was just a wonderful time in the development of the arts in New Orleans.
What led you to bring your work moving forward to the medical community?
Well, I was always interested in how to make art relevant to people because I felt like so much art is in wonderful venues, galleries and museums and showcases where most of the population, unfortunately, doesn't get to. I wanted it to be part of everyday experience. And my best friend at the time sent me a clipping about the work of Roger Ulrich, who's the leading researcher in the world on evidence-based design and art and healing. And she sent me a letter with the article saying, you've been doing this kind of artwork all your life. And so I went and spoke with Pat Quinlan, who was then the CEO at Ochsner, and told him my dream to make art part of the experience and part of healing, because the clinical tests that Roger Ulrich did were absolutely incredible in all the great outcomes from using art and healing, with reduced blood pressure, reduced stress, reduced hospital stays, and on and on and on. One of the first projects I did there was the Ochsner Center for Children, and we won first prize internationally from the Society for the Art and Healthcare. It was presented in Canada for our work at Ochsner at that time.
Tell us about your technique, your creative process. What inspires your work, and how do you go about capturing that?
I've done pieces from all parts of the world, but the work that I focus on predominantly is what I know best. And somehow I feel what you know best, you can best express. And that was the landscapes and seascapes of my childhood. I was very fortunate as a young child to go to a wonderful, glorious fishing camp on the North Shore with my great-grandparents and grandparents and parents and extended families. We also would go to another hunting club out in Barataria Bay, also the panhandle of Florida. I became very familiar with the Gulf Coast landscape, and I used to sit under the fishing camp and look at all the patterns in the water, and many of my paintings are about just those places.
What will we see in the retrospective exhibit?
Mostly painting and mixed media works. There are a lot of large-scale paintings, which I'm very excited about. The biggest one is 10 feet.
10 feet, that's incredible.
And Laurie Sims, who wrote my catalog when I had a traveling exhibition, she is the associate curator of contemporary art at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and she told me that as far as she knew, they were the largest watercolors in the world, because I've done some bigger than that are in the show now. I've done them up to about 16 feet in watercolor.
And how do you go about your process?
I work from photographs. I do very small studies to start with. So I started doing large silver prints on German watercolor paper. I would do a light image and then paint it out with watercolor or pastel, and then work with watercolor, pastel, charcoal, graphite, and pastel pencil over it. And that's the way the process developed.
What brings you the most joy as you see this body of work on display now?
It brings me great joy just to see them and watch the evolution of work up to the present. And I'm looking forward to creating my best work now here at Chriswood.
Artist Emery Clark, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you so much, Diane.
Emery Clark Retrospective kicks off with an opening reception Saturday evening, September 29th from 4:30 until 6:30 in Christwood's Atrium Art Gallery, 100 Christwood Boulevard in Covington. WWNO is holding a listener meet and greet in coordination with this event. Hope to see you there. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. We travel now to ancient China as the New Orleans Opera Association opens its 76th season with Puccini's Turandot. Joining me to talk about this fairy tale fantasy is the New Orleans Opera's executive director, Todd Simmons.
Thank you for having me today.
You have an exciting new season unfolding and with some surprises.
We absolutely do. We're doing concerts called Opera Nouvelle, which is a new program. We'll have one coming up for Turandot for the opening production at Xavier University, actually. And then the next one, which will be in October, will be at the Sculpture Garden with NOMA, which will be for our next opera, which is Pygmalion. It'll be a free concert where the singers will be moving through the Sculpture Garden, singing pieces specifically connected to different sculptures, since that's what Pygmalion is about. It's a sculpture coming to life.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And what else unfolds in the season?
In the spring, our first production will be Abduction from the Seraglio, which will be Mozart. Then a new piece by Lara Auerbach called The Blind. And then we'll end the season with Verdi's Rigoletto. One other event we have will be a haunted affair at the Opera Guild home on October 6th. This will be the opera ball for the upcoming year for the Women's Guild of the New Orleans Opera.
It's jam-packed.
With things for the audience for them to really enjoy.
Your season opener, Turandot, is a curious one for me because of the pronunciation. I've heard Turandot, heard Turandot. Which is it?
You can look this up on the internet and you can find some extremely vigorous conversations and arguments about that exact topic. I personally do pronounce the T at the end of the name. First time I did this production, it was with a conductor who was Italian and conducted it at La Scala, and with a director who was Persian. And I believe that the argument is that the Persian pronunciation of the name is without the T, so you would say Turandot. Lotfi, who was the director, who was Persian, said it's an Italian opera, so he was going to pronounce it with the T. The conductor, Eduardo Müller, said, yes, pronounce the T, but do it very, very lightly.
They say love conquers all, and mm-hmm. in this season opener, that pursuit has a lot of folks trying to hang on to their heads. Why is that?
Well, the Princess Turandot has sworn against love, and sworn that she will never marry unless a suitor can answer three riddles. And if they cannot answer those riddles, then they lose their heads. The opera actually begins with the Prince of Persia, who has failed to answer the three riddles, and he is being escorted in front of Prince Khalaf to his execution. And when Turandot comes out to give the thumbs down that he is to lose his head, Khalaf sees her and falls instantly in love with her, and decides that even though he watches the prince being beheaded, he's going to go through with it himself and try to answer the three riddles.
Princess Turandot is not very nice, is she?
No, not very nice. But at the same time, we hear in her aria where she tells us that the reason why she is this way is because women of her ancestors were tortured and murdered. And because of what men did to them, she has made this vow to avenge them. Khalaf answers the three riddles, and Princess Turandot begs not to have to marry him, even though that's her deal. He gives the ultimatum saying, if you can tell me my name, because he's never told her what his name is. if you can tell me my name by sunrise, then I will relieve you from your obligation to marry me.
Tell us about the cast. Who's singing in the lead roles?
We have a fantastic cast, a really, truly international cast. We start with The Prince, sung by David Pomeroy. Soprano Turandot is Alexandra Lucian. Amazing, both of these. And new to this role is the soprano Raquel Gonzalez. Both her premiere in the role, Servant Liu, and her premiere with New Orleans Opera. In fact, all three of these principals, it's the first time for them to sing with New Orleans Opera. As you may or may not know, Robert Lyle, their general and artistic director, auditions singers all over the world to find the best people for those roles that he can bring in for these productions. We also have many very talented leading singers from the local area, including Casey Candabat. We have Chauncey Packer and Dennis Jesse, who are singing the Ping Pang and Pong roles, who are three ministers to the Princess Turandot. And Ivan Griffin is singing the Mandarin. And also Tony Bentley, who we all know from the racetrack and from the movies, is the Emperor, who is the father of Turandot.
What would you say endears contemporary audiences to this work?
This work is a classic fairy tale. It is about love conquering. It is about obstacles that are being broken down. It's also about strong female leadership, about questioning of that strong female leadership and that overriding and overcoming. Ultimately, it's a happy ending. Yes, it begins with a beheading, but it does end with a quite joyous hymn where everybody celebrates that we've now have found happiness.
So love triumphs.
Love triumphs.
New Orleans Opera Executive Director Todd Simmons, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
The New Orleans Opera Association presents Puccini's Turandot, September 28th and 30th at the Mahalia Jackson Theater. That's our show for this week. Major support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Additional support comes from Christwood Retirement Community, the Contemporary Arts Center, and the New Orleans Opera Association. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.